You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 11th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll analyse the Portuguese election result and look at why they matter for Europe as a whole. Ramadan has begun and still no ceasefire. We'll discuss the implications of the continuing conflict in Gaza during the Muslim holy month. Charles Hecker is here and is across the global headlines.
Good morning, Georgina. The US embassy is airlifting its staff out of Haiti. Ukraine is inching closer to getting F-16 jets. Fresh polling lows for Japan's prime minister. And the Washington Post is going to tell us how to love our dogs even more.
Is that even possible? We'll join our China expert, Isabel Hilton, to discuss the ongoing Two Sessions Congress and changes to the Hong Kong security law. We'll have a roundup of news from the Balkans and...
And the Oscar goes to Christopher Nolan Oppenheimer.
The highlights, snubs and shocking moments from Hollywood's biggest night. Plus, the Pentagon says UFOs don't exist. But they would say that, wouldn't they? That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Ukraine has rebuffed Pope Francis's call to negotiate an end to the war with Russia, with President Volodymyr Zelensky saying the pontiff was engaging in virtual mediation. The US military has carried out an operation in Haiti to airlift non-essential embassy personnel from the country as the Caribbean nation reels under a state of emergency. And Oppenheimer, the blockbuster biopic about the race to build the first atomic bomb, claimed 7 Academy Awards, including the prestigious Best Picture trophy last night. More on that story a little bit later on. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day. Now, we begin in Portugal, where 10.8 million people were eligible to vote in yesterday's parliamentary election. The snap poll was called after the abrupt resignation of the socialist leader António Costa last November following a corruption probe. This is Portugal's second election in 2 years. The two main parties, the Socialist Party, or PS, and the Social Democratic Party, the PSD, of the centre-left and right, respectively, have alternated power since the end of the dictatorship 50 years ago. Well, I'm joined now from Lisbon by the journalist Joana Ramiro. Thanks very much for being with us this early. I know it's a late night for you, Joana. What are the numbers coming out so far?
Hi, Georgina. First of all, let me say it's an early morning for me. I have a very small son that you might hear in the background. So if you hear very cute baby noises, you'll know what they are. Indeed. I mean, it's a very interesting night, perhaps historic for a few reasons, some of them more curious rather than shocking, and others quite unprecedented in Portugal's democratic history, which is celebrating this year its 50th anniversary. And perhaps ironically, to start off, we have nearly 50 far-right populist MPs in parliament this morning. That's 48 in total, in fact. Chega, a party called Enough, has grown exponentially, quadrupled its number of MPs in parliament. It was already the third biggest force, but now has really exceeded itself with 18% of the vote. The other story, as you say, or you start off with, the PSD, which has run under an electoral coalition under the acronym AD, or Democratic Alliance in Portuguese, and the Socialist Party, very much ended up head-to-head, tete-a-tete, with 29.5% for the Conservatives and 28.6 for the Socialists. In terms of seats, that does have a difference of 2. So it's 79 out of the 230 total parliament for the Conservatives and 77 for the Socialists. None of that is obviously the majority of parliament, so there is a lot to play. One should add as well that whilst these are not expected to make a massive difference, there's still 2 electoral circles to be counted. Those are the European and the wider world circles, which take a couple of weeks usually to count because the votes are sent via postal ballot. So this is basically the summary of the night. It means we don't have a government this morning. The president will now have to decide what to do from his indications from the last few days and certainly from the end of the campaign. We know that he will talk to the leader of the party with the biggest number of votes, that is the Conservative Coalition, AD. So Luis Montenegro will be invited to form a government of some description. The question then stands, since he does not have a majority, what will he do to create a stable government? Will he or won't he invite Chiga to form a government? He has constantly said, Montenegro, that he would not, but this is pre-actual election. So let's see what he does after the fact. He certainly wouldn't have enough numbers otherwise. The only other parties to his right or along his political axis would not be enough to form a majority government. The left in total, the socialists plus the wider left, are just short of majority as well. So neither option would be what one could call a stable majority government.
Let's talk about Chega. I mean, the party is just 5 years old. Can you tell us about the rise of the right and what is fueling this?
The party is ever so slightly older than that. It's eight years old. It started coming around in 2015. In fact, it elected its very first MP in 2015, André Ventura, its ongoing leader, and perhaps the power, the machine making it all work, really. There are very few other names within the party that are nationally known. There's a young woman who's now raising through the ranks, but otherwise André Ventura is still very much the face and the name to know. Its rise is perhaps, you know, unsurprising if we see what happens across Europe at large. Growth of populist far-right movements is not unheard of, both in Central and Eastern Europe, but also in our neighboring Spain, perhaps our most similar political story paradigm with Vox. And André Ventura very much molds himself after such examples. He loves to copy, both in mannerisms and in narrative, Donald Trump, actually, but he also takes from both Vox, Marine Le Pen, and a series of other far-right well-known figures. I think his demands, or the demands of the party, echo very much with a lot of discontents of the wider population. One might think, oh, that means immigration. I don't think that's the case. I think where he really does echo with wider swathes of the population, and certainly in these elections, is over a protest vote at large. People are discontent with traditional options of PSD and PS, but also on things like, you know, just wide populist slogans like giving people better working conditions or better living conditions, or just a right for a bigger say in their lives. People feel disempowered politically as well as socially. And this is where André Ventura really shines, is when he talks directly to people who feel like they have not been part of, an empowered society.
And yet, Costa and his party won the last election with an absolute majority. I mean, it seems extraordinary that voter support has been lost in just 2 years.
I think there's a part of that that was COVID. You know, António Costa led Portugal very successfully, one could argue, given the circumstances, through the pandemic. However, since then, since 2022, we've had the fall from grace, not only in terms of government that has been, the object of a series of scandals, ministers involved in a series of either political palavas or, as we just, seen recently in Operation Influencer, the alleged influence peddling and corruption scandals that happened within that government, but also not having been able to successfully meet the expectations of a population that has been struggling with the cost of living crisis. So from salaries that are stagnant or semi-stagnant to really a huge rise of living costs, and especially in housing, Costa's government administration has not been able to meet the expectations of the average Portuguese person, and his successor, Pedro Nunes, has also throughout the campaign not been able to convince the population. One should argue or say that he was the Minister for Infrastructure under António Costa until he himself stepped down a few years ago over sort of not exactly corruption, but a scandal to do with the Portuguese Airlines, TAP, for which he was responsible, and the effectively renationalization of the company, but the fact that the outgoing CEO had a sort of golden handshake, let's call it, at the time. And yes, and that, you know, sort of Pedro Nunes felt that kind of pressure from the, you know, the country was too much.
As you were saying, this is kind of a trend that we are seeing across Europe. It's also the last parliamentary vote scheduled to be held in the EU before next June's European Parliament election. What are the implications for Europe now that Portugal is also heading in that direction?
Absolutely. I think Portugal, who was so often defined as the good student of Europe during the Troika austerity years, and then more recently as a paragon for good socialist leadership and rule, is now being seen perhaps as some sort of, or these elections seen as some sort of litmus test for Europe in a few months' time. One could argue, although one cannot be sure, but that there is a similarity going to happen, or a similar phenomenon going to happen across Europe at large, rise from far-right populist forces where they exist and they have the strength for that. And I suspect that will certainly be the case in the countries where we've heard of these parties already. In Germany with Deutschland, the Alternative for Deutschland, AfD, Alternative for Germany, rather, one should say in English, in France with Marine Le Pen, as I've already mentioned. Spain won, I wouldn't know, because currently Pedro Sanchez has been very strong in the polls, but, you know, there's a few months to go still. But one can see it reproducing itself over and over again. Mm-hmm. So it is really a question of seeing, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of people in Brussels are currently looking at Portugal with very worried eyes indeed, unless they are, of course, part of the far-right bloc inside the Parliament, European Parliament.
Joanna, thank you very much. And wasn't your baby so good? Joanna Romero there. This is The Globalist. It is 8:12 in Zurich, 7:12 here in London. Ramadan began last night, meaning that any hopes of a ceasefire in Gaza before the beginning of the Muslim holy month have been dashed. Negotiations broke down on Thursday when the Hamas delegation left Cairo, where talks had been taking place. Discussions are expected to resume this week. Hamas says that since October the 7th, over 31,000 people have been killed in Gaza by Israeli attacks. Well, I'm joined now by the journalist and Middle East correspondent Ruth Michelson, who joins us on the line from Istanbul. Ruth, good to speak to you again. I wonder if you could begin by giving us an update on the situation in Gaza over the weekend.
Well, I mean, the situation in Gaza as it stands, I mean, we're just getting news alerts now talking about the number of airstrikes that occurred overnight as Ramadan began, exactly as you mentioned. And that, you know, there is increasing concern now that there is, or alarm that the number of people that have died in Gaza is now surpassed easily 30,000. And that we're now seeing increasing attention to concerns about the urgent need to get aid in, discussions about what is happening in the north of the northern Gaza Strip, where there is profound pockets of starvation, and discussions around what is happening after, or the best way to administer this aid, given that there was an aid drop last week that killed five people when there was a parachute that failed to open. Mm.
Also this weekend, Joe Biden gave a speech. It was fairly contradictory. What did he say?
Well, Joe Biden was also caught on a hot mic at the end of last week talking about the need to have a kind of come to Jesus moment, with the words that he used, with Netanyahu, and then seemed overall quite largely unconcerned about the fact that he'd been caught on the hot mic and said, yes, this is, you know, this is what I intend to do. He also spoke to MSNBC, the US cable channel, and basically talked about the potential that he was willing to go to Israel and speak in front of the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, to make his point about the need to get humanitarian aid into Gaza.
Let's have a look at Ramadan now. Ramadan began last night. Why was the beginning of Ramadan such an important deadline, and how might the fact that we are now in the Muslim holy month affect the situation?
Well, Ramadan, holy month of Ramadan is supposed to be a period of fasting and contemplation, and it tends to heighten the situation in Jerusalem, because there are Palestinians that normally get access to Jerusalem to be able to go and pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the second holiest site in Islam. And there has been, in recent weeks, there have been threats from Israeli officials that they would prevent this from happening. We've seen since the 7th of October that Israel has massively curtailed access to Friday prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And this has essentially been seen as a way to ramp up tensions in Jerusalem since the 7th of October, and that this is likely to be even more heightened now as we move into Ramadan, and that this will have a relationship with the situation on the ground in Gaza, given that people want to have access to the mosque in order to be able to pray. And that in Gaza, that Hamas see this as something that for them is a red line.
The ceasefire talks, as we said, broke off last week. Are they going to resume this week? And who will be there? We know that Israel refused to send a representative to the talks in Cairo last week because they had asked Hamas for a list of Israeli hostages, which wasn't provided. Will they join in?
The talks so far have been indirect. We saw that there was some discussion between the head of the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, and the head of the CIA on Friday. Egyptian officials have said that they hope to resume ceasefire talks with members of Hamas this coming week. But some Hamas officials left Cairo late last week and said it was pausing its participation in the talks, according to the Wall Street Journal. And so there are hopes that these talks will resume this week, and that there will be some way to find a path forward. But that has really looking more fragile than it has in some time. We saw considerable optimism in the past that seems to have faded, in the sense that there is considerable disagreement over a discussion of a permanent ceasefire as opposed to one that would last about 40 days. And that also that Israel has said that they want to see a list of which Israeli hostages that are held by Hamas and some other armed groups are still alive. And Hamas have said that there is a need to have a ceasefire in place before they can basically make a list of that information. And so things seem to have reached quite an impasse at the moment. And it's not necessarily clear whether the added pressure of Ramadan and, again, the threat of an Israeli offensive on Rafah during the holy month of Ramadan is going to be enough to really restart talks in a more earnest way.
Ruth, thank you very much indeed. That's Ruth Michelson there. Now, still to come on the programme.
It's bye-bye Barnabas as Serbia's longest-serving Prime Minister bows out. I'm Guy Delorne, Monocle's man in the Balkans, and I'll be telling you all about that, as well as voter busing bother and a bird poisoning mystery.
This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
just coming up to 22 minutes past seven here in London. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio with me, Georgina Godwin. And joining me in the studio is Charles Hecker, senior partner at Control Risks and an author.
Hopefully in just a few days, yes, that may become the case.
Charles, it's lovely to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
Let's start with the FT. And this is a story we've been reporting in our headlines. It's the violence in Haiti and the US embassy staff being airlifted out.
That's right. We're going to the FT under the headline of US airlifts embassy staff out of Haiti as violence escalates. This is, of course, an ongoing story, but apparently the violence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, and around the country has reached such an extreme that non-essential and most embassy staff from the United States has been airlifted out and evacuated. The FT tells us that other countries, including France and Spain, have also reduced their embassy staff or suspended operations in country because of the violence. What seems to be happening in Haiti is that the country is beset by groups of rival gangs. What these gangs have done, though, is that they've combined and united. And so the violence there is really unprecedented, and the country's undergoing a fresh wave of violence. What they're protesting is that the president who took who took power in 2021, promised elections and has not held them. He is not allowed to reenter the country. He was in Kenya seeking support from the Kenyan army. He is now holed up in Puerto Rico. But apparently all of Haiti, the FT tells us, is under complete lockdown.
It's extraordinary. And of course, it's a country with a very, very troubled history.
That's right. I mean, this is we are back again in a sort of cycle of violence. There was a time in Haiti when, of course, the violence came from the prime minister's office and from the ruling family of the Duvaliers. Now it's just sort of gang violence covering the streets. There's a humanitarian crisis unfolding across Haiti. The border with the Dominican Republic next door is locked shut to prevent a refugee crisis. And really, it just is. Just when you think that sort of things couldn't get any worse in Haiti, they actually do.
Mm. Let's go to the New York Times now, and this is a story about F-16s going to Ukraine.
That's right. So here's the headline in the New York Times. It says Ukraine could deploy F-16s as soon as July, but only a few. And so what this story is another one of the frustrating tales of the sort of two steps forward, one step back, or maybe even one step forward, two steps back in the story of Western aid to Ukraine. And what the story takes us through is the number of F-16 jets that have been promised by the United States and Europe, the number of pilots who are supposedly getting trained to fly those aircraft, the facilities on the ground in Ukraine to maintain them and to launch them. And all of it is a story of a little bit of frustration. There are 12 pilots so far from Ukraine that are being trained. That's less than a full squadron, the Times tells us, and it's fewer than were initially promised. And of the 45 F-16s that have been promised by Denmark, by the Netherlands, by the United States, as few as six of them will probably be ready. So it's really sort of a kind of push-me-pull-you situation and just very gradual progress.
And they're also explaining how the pilots not only need to learn to fly new machines, but need to get their English up to scratch and all sorts. I mean, it's a very long learning curve.
That's right. They draw a comparison between, there's a training facility in Romania where all of this training is meant to shortly start and then finally finish and deliver ready-to-go jets and pilots. And they draw a contrast between the NATO pilots that are training there and the Ukrainian pilots that are training there. And, the NATO pilots grew up on Western jets. The Ukrainian pilots grew up on Soviet jets. And there have been problems in adjusting to the equipment. And you're right, there is some emphasis on the language and the fact that the Ukrainians have had to come up to speed on their English. They're good fighters. They're good pilots. They're good at something else. And they have to be trained to be good at an F-16.
Mm. And would it be a game changer if all of those planes were fully operational?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the Times' answer to that is mixed. There aren't enough of them. And then, of course, the F-16s will come with weapons, but they will need more. And those are that's where we're experiencing difficulty in the delivering of ammunition to Ukraine. Ukraine's military runways have been damaged by Russian bombing. And so this is an incremental ratcheting up of Ukraine's capabilities. But no, Georgina, it's probably not a game changer.
Right. So, listen, there's another jet story, and that is the fact that Japan is possibly thinking of exporting next-generation fighter jets to be co-developed with Britain and Italy. But according to a recent poll, 44.7% of people said that should never be allowed. Now, this is just one result from a poll, which is actually showing some pretty damaging and dire results.
That's right. We're going to go to the Japan Times now. And if you are a suffering politician anywhere else in the world, take heart, because things aren't as bad as they are for you as they are in Japan. The Japan Times headline says Kishida cabinet support rate hits fresh low at 20% over funds scandal. And so the Japan Times takes us through an unraveling scandal about slush funds and undeclared income among Japanese politicians, with indictments sort of flying around, and Kishida in a political crisis because the danger level, quote unquote, from the Japan Times in Japanese polling is when your popularity falls below 30%, you're meant to be in deep, deep trouble, and they are now dropping well below 22% approval rates, which really is just rock bottom. Kishida was elected in 2021. The next general election in Japan is scheduled for 2025. And it looks like the cabinet and the LDP government is going to really stumble through the next year or so until they get to that election.
Mm. And of course, big economic problems. Japan's lost its status as the world's third biggest economy.
Yeah, that was a real shocker. And that's something that, of course, is a source of major national pride to Japan, you know, a small island nation that for decades has punched above its weight technologically and economically. And it's lost its place to Germany in the league tables of the world's largest economies. And it's even more embittering to Japan because Germany, of course, at the moment is in a recession.
Yeah. Okay. Here is the story I have been looking forward to.
That's right. This is the story I've also wanted to talk about more than anything else. Amid the news today, we're going to the Washington Post, which has a headline that says six ways to get more joy with your dog. And I almost want to turn this into a quiz with the dog lover across the microphone opposite. And some of this, I think, is really quite surprising. The first thing that the Washington Post tells us to do with our dog is to gaze deeply into our dog's eyes. Georgina, is that something that sounds familiar?
Well, it is. But also, some dogs see that as a form of aggression. So I was slightly puzzled by that.
Interesting. So the Post tells us that both dog owners and dogs get a boost of oxytocin from looking deeply into each other's eyes. The next thing that the Post says we should be doing with our pets, with our dogs, is to embrace baby talk, the sort of goo goo gaga silly talk that people do with their dogs. They say that high-pitched tone is actually quite comforting to dogs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We are told that we should take our dogs with us when we run errands. I hope they find that more interesting than we do when we're running errands. They say snuggling is very, very good for you and very, very good for your dog. It helps to cheer you up. It says that you can teach an old dog new tricks. So we're meant to be teaching our dogs how to jump through hula hoops and roll over. And then finally, they interview a lady who every morning has a warm beverage with her dog. Sometimes she has the bone broth and sometimes our dog has the bone broth.
That all sounds delightful. Did you watch Crufts?
No. Of the award shows that have been ongoing lately, I was watching something a little bit further west.
Well, I can tell you that an Australian shepherd named Viking was crowned best in show, and second was a fox terrier from Japan called Zen.
Congratulations to both.
Charles Hecker, thank you very much indeed. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Ukraine has rebuffed Pope Francis's call to negotiate an end to the war with Russia, with President Volodymyr Zelensky saying the pontiff was engaging in virtual mediation and his foreign minister saying Kyiv would never capitulate. Francis said that when things were going badly for a party to a conflict, one had to show the courage of the white flag and negotiate. The US military has carried out an operation in Haiti to airlift non-essential embassy personnel from the country and added US forces to bolster embassy security as the Caribbean nation reels under a state of emergency. The operation was the latest sign of Haiti's troubles as gang violence threatens to bring down the government and has led thousands to flee their homes. And Oppenheimer, the blockbuster biopic about the race to build the first atomic bomb, claimed 7 Academy Awards, including the prestigious Best Picture trophy on Sunday, as Hollywood celebrated a triumphant year in film. Outside the venue, hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters angered by the Israel-Gaza conflict shouted and slowed traffic in the streets surrounding the Dolby Theatre. More on that story a little later on. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It is 15:32 in Beijing, 7:32 here in London. China's two sessions Congress began last week. During the event, nearly 3,000 members of the National People's Congress, the NPC, China's parliament, meet to set the legislative agenda for the coming year. The Congress also hosts the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, in which some 2,000 members of the CCP and civil society debate political priorities. So far, the country's most important political bodies have touched on economic recovery, the modernization of the army, foreign relations, and the question of Taiwan. Isabel Hilton, China expert and visiting professor at King's College London, is on the line to discuss this further. Isabel, thanks for joining us. During last year's two sessions, delegates officially approved Xi Jinping for an unprecedented third term as president. Has his increased control since then impacted on the meeting this year?
Well, I think we're seeing the constant songs of praise to Xi Jinping. It's really quite striking. You know, this used to be a time when you could meet all sorts of people and all sorts of things were debated and discussed, you know, in perhaps more liberal times. But this time, this two sessions, two striking things. One, a slogan that Xi Jinping coined when visiting a Rust Belt factory back in the autumn, which is to do with establishing, you know, technological dominance has been very, very much in evidence. And secondly, for decades, the prime minister has given a press conference at the two sessions meeting. I mean, a rare event in China, but one you could count on every year, not this year. The prime minister, Li Qiang, a Xi Jinping appointee, appears to have been afraid of saying the wrong thing, of deviating from Xi Jinping's line, and no press conference, instead of which we have had lots of broadcasts of a rather repetitive formula in which essentially Xi Jinping gives instruction to various sectors, various delegates, various groups who've assembled for the meeting.
So what does this increasing opaqueness tell us about China's direction and Xi's leadership?
Well, it's not a great sign. I mean, it tells us in some sense that Xi Jinping is firmly in control, which is not something that was in doubt. But it also, you know, the fact that the prime minister can't seem to sort of speak on his own account. There was a press conference from Wang Yi, the foreign minister, which very much repeated the party line. You've got this kind of monochrome repetition of slogans and of policies which have come from the top. And that's not a healthy sign. In a country as big as China, you do need more debate. You need more sense that people are empowered to not only to repeat policy slogans, but actually to implement policy. So when you get this kind of top-down affirmation of control and quite palpable fear of deviating from it, you get people going through the motions rather than being creative or proactive with policy. And that's always a bad thing in China, because you've got people who are saying they're kind of implementing policy and obeying the law, and underneath not a lot is happening. Mm.
Now, Hong Kong's chosen this week to announce a new national security law. What's the detail on that?
Oh, dear. Well, this is the final attempt to legislate what was called Article 23, which was Article 23 in the original Basic Law. This has been trouble since 2003. The attempt to implement or to legislate for national security, which is what this is, was what stimulated the massive demonstrations back in 2003, which essentially continued as, you know, the people of Hong Kong tried to defend their rights right up until the passing of a Beijing-imposed national security law 2 years ago. Now, since then, I mean, we've had arrests of activists, arrests of civil society, prominent people like Jimmy Lai, the newspaper owner, on trial for under national security laws. We've had a diminution of rights. So you would not think that Hong Kong, or at least Beijing's rule in Hong Kong, was under any kind of threat. But they've chosen this moment, the moment of the two sessions, to announce that Hong Kong will now finally enact its own version of the national security law. And the problem with the national security law as devised and implemented in China is that the definitions are very vague. So, you know, it talks about Hong Kong being run by patriots, you know, of course, who's a patriot and what's not patriotic is defined by Beijing. A whole series of very, very vague but very broad potential crimes which could lead to life imprisonment. You know that national security cases will be tried in special courts. So the kind of civil defences, or the defences of civil rights that Hong Kong used to have. Hong Kong never had full democracy, but it did have rights, it did have rule of law, it did have protections. Those are really a thing of the past. I'm afraid they've all gone now.
I mean, what does it mean then for the future of Hong Kong, particularly when you look at its status as a financial centre?
Well, the irony is that a lot of this legislation is about, you know, suspicious foreigners and suspicious relations with foreign governments. Well, considering that was Hong Kong's enormous strength, you have to wonder how this is going to work. And, you know, there has been a big exodus from Hong Kong since the passing of Beijing's national, the enactment of Beijing's national security law. People have relocated to Singapore, they've relocated to Taiwan. I can't see that really recovering under this, because what this legislation does is that it brings to Hong Kong the kind of insecurity that we've seen for foreigners in China. And there really aren't, you know, why should people go and live and work in Hong Kong when there might be a knock on the door? It's not attractive.
Isabel, thank you. Very much indeed. That is China expert and visiting professor at King's College London, Isabel Hilton. And this is Monocle Radio. It is 8:38 in Ljubljana and 7:38 here in London. Guy Delaunay is Monocle's Balkans correspondent. He joins us on the line now for a roundup of news from the region. Good morning to you, Guy.
Good morning, Georgina.
We are starting with Serbia's Prime Minister. Tell us about her.
Indeed we are. This is Ana Brnabic, who has been the Prime Minister since 2017, which means she's Serbia's longest-serving Prime Minister ever. And, of course, she was also the first female head of government and the first gay head of government that Serbia has ever had. And we're talking about her today because this is probably her final day in that office, because the National Assembly of Serbia is due to meet today, and they are expected to vote for Ana Brnabic to become the new Speaker of Parliament. And that would, of course, mean that she would no longer be serving as Prime Minister. So it's a bit of a changing of the guard.
What's her legacy? I mean, is she seen as being a success?
Well, this is the thing. She's largely seen as being somebody who implemented what President Aleksandar Vučić wanted and acted in many terms as a mouthpiece for President Aleksandar Vučić. And it's fair to say that in some respects, this is more or less what people would have expected, because Aleksandar Vučić is the person in unquestioned charge of Serbia. But people, of course, were hoping against hope that they would get something different from Ana Brnabic because of who she is. And, you know, I know people who have worked with her before she became a politician, and who rated her very highly for the work that she'd done in economics and in business and in development. And so they were hoping that she would be something perhaps a bit different in government. And of course, you know, the LGBTQ plus community in Serbia were hoping that having a gay head of government would mean that their rights would improve during Ms. Brnabic's time in office. And they haven't particularly, although it's notable that Ms. Brnabic became the first head of government to attend the Belgrade Pride marches. And, you know, merely having a head of government who's gay in a country like Serbia does, you know, that even if she's not implementing lots of reforms, it does stand in itself as a signal to people in Serbia that, you know, Serbia's progressing in ways that they might not have anticipated.
Let's zoom in now on Belgrade and the rerun of the municipal elections. Tell us why this is happening and what the current concerns are.
Now, it's a big deal, the rerun of Belgrade's municipal elections. I know people, you know, you sometimes look at local elections and think, so what? But the battle for Belgrade City Assembly is really a big one to see if there's going to be a credible opposition movement over the next few years of government. Because we just had elections in December for a lot of municipalities and also the parliamentary elections. The parliamentary elections left the governing Progressive Party of Mr. Vucic firmly in charge. The city assembly elections left a hung assembly, and they haven't been able to form any sort of governing majority in that city assembly. And the opposition, Serbia Against Violence, which describes itself as a pro-EU coalition, they are hoping that they can take the city assembly in a rerun of this election. They're also very keen to impress on everybody that they believe there was a lot of voter manipulation in December's election, that there were voters being bussed in from places outside of Belgrade, that they were registering them outside of Belgrade and bringing them in, registering them in Belgrade and then bringing them in from the places where they actually lived to vote for the Progressive Party. That's the allegation of the opposition parties, which has been backed by an independent election monitor. It's been hotly denied, of course, by the government. So this rerun, the stakes are high. If the opposition can actually get past the finishing post here, if they can take charge of Belgrade City Assembly, they'll have a very powerful foothold from which to, you know, launch a long-term strategy to challenge the progressives on a national level.
Let's turn to wildlife in Serbia, because there's a big mystery over what's killing birds.
And this is something which really troubled me, Georgina, because I'm aware of what a paradise for bird watchers Serbia is, particularly the northeast of Serbia, around a town called Kikinda. And, you know, are you a twitcher, Georgina?
I'm not, and I didn't have you down as one either, Guy, I must say.
Not really, but I used to, on my bike rides in the UK, I always used to have a little spotter's guide in my cycling jersey in my back pocket so that I could whip it out whenever I saw a bird and I didn't particularly recognise it. So I'm not strictly speaking of a birder, but I'm willing to admire them as and when. And Kikinda is famous for its population of long-eared owls. It's known as the world capital of long-eared owls. And this discovery last week of 800 dead birds in the Kikinda area is very troubling for the owls and for other birds of prey who live there. Because while the birds of prey, while the birds who were found dead weren't those birds of prey, it's all part of that ecosystem. The owls actually depend on these other birds who have died, the jackdaws and the rooks, because they actually build the nests that the owls and these other birds of prey use to rear their own young. Because I didn't know this, but long-eared owls don't build their own nests. Huh. And ornithologists reckon that this is a result of a mass poisoning. And they're in the midst at the moment of getting tests for this. And the tests have shown it wasn't bird flu, it wasn't West Nile virus. The hot suspicion is that frustrated farmers being frustrated by rodents eating their crops, have scattered poisoned seed around, and rather than getting the rodents, they've got these jackdaws and rooks. This is a problem for everybody, because as I said, the jackdaws and rooks go, and that has an impact further up the chain. And if the long-eared owls and birds of prey go, then the rodent infestations will get worse.
Absolutely. Guy, thank you very much indeed. And if I could just recommend to you the Merlin Bird ID app that will replace your book. You just record the bird and it'll tell you exactly what it is. It's such fun.
I'm having that.
Thank you very much to our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It was was Hollywood's main event last night, the 96th Academy Awards. The Oscars, hosted by late-night TV presenter Jimmy Kimmel for the fourth time, took place at the Dolby Theatre in Los Angeles, and it was televised and celebrated all over the world, including here in London. And Karen Krasanovich, film critic and regular Monocle Radio contributor, was at one of those London events and had a very late night, I believe.
Yeah, it was very late. Yes, it was.
Now, we know Oppenheimer pretty much swept the board.
Yes, yes. Seven out of 11. Sorry, 13 nominations and 7 Oscars. And Poor Things, 11 nominations and 4 Oscars. And then it went down 2-1-1. So there you go. But what a great night. It was brilliant. Did you see any of it?
No, I was watching Crufts instead.
Oh, you're watching Crufts.
Just shows where our different priorities lie. No, I was sleeping. But those were the big wins. What about snubs? Because Barbie, there's been so much talk about this.
Yeah, well, actually, Kimmel addressed that in his opening speech. He goes, and what about the biggest film of the year, Barbie? And of course, you know, it's made more money than Oppenheimer has. And everybody's clapping. And he goes, why are you clapping? You didn't even, you know, get Gerwig as director, and you're responsible, you know. And he's really just laid it on the line. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
He tread very carefully. It was sometimes he thought maybe a little too much, but light-handed, and the pace was great.
Yeah.
So addressed Barbieheimer. Really, he didn't leave anything unturned.
And of course, Ryan Gosling did a live performance.
Oh, I'm still ringing in my ears. He did the, you know, the Marilyn Monroe dress with all the dancing guys and the top hats and everything, and all in pink. He did I'm Just Ken to that sort of Busby Berkeley style. It was just sensational.
It sounds absolutely amazing. Any shocking moments? I hear there was a bit of a wardrobe malfunction.
I think it was really more covering for awkwardness, really. There was one jaw-dropping moment when Lily Gladstone did not win. She's won SAG, and she and Emma Stone were sort of running neck and neck, but they thought for sure that Lily Gladstone was going to be a shoo-in. She's the actress from Killers of the Flower Moon. They were calling each other the Eternity Stones, apparently, in various interviews. And Emma Stone beat her. And I just couldn't believe it. And Emma's going, I've got a wardrobe malfunction. I think it was just because she felt so awkward that she didn't expect to win. So that was a heartbreaking moment. That it would have been nice to have had a Native American win the first Oscar for that.
Absolutely. Category. What about political speeches?
Oh, wow. Well, Jonathan Glazer, who's a light touch, a really nice guy, sat next to him at the Critics Circle Awards earlier this year, got up and gave a very even-handed, I thought, and I haven't analyzed it, but very even-handed commentary about the Middle East. And he seemed, and it was short. He didn't overstay his, I mean, he had it written down. And that was really about all the politics there were. There wasn't a lot. Then again, they had started the ceremony early in order to subvert some of the protests that were blocking some of the streets, reportedly. I didn't see any, but apparently there were.
Yeah, we're told that there were hundreds of people out there who were stopping traffic.
Yeah.
So do you think, then, the film industry has recovered from the strikes? Will it be a better year for Hollywood?
I don't think they've recovered. No, I don't think they've recovered from COVID yet, really. Hollywood, I think, is getting more inclusive, more diverse. I mean, there's a lot of international features started scattering. I mean, Britain got a best international feature with Jonathan Glazer because it's in German, you know. And I think it's just much more because they've expanded their voting to 10,000 members around the world. And that makes it less like, the L.A. voting, is your sister in that movie, we'll vote for you kind of thing, and more global. But it also means that I really don't understand why Poor Things did so well at the end. It's still a horse race.
Mm-hmm. And the frocks, of course.
Amazing. Really great things. Although Zendaya came out looking amazing, but she has no organs. She's just so slender. I was looking at her thinking, really, she's had them all removed. But she looked amazing. And she looked like such a nice person as well. But there were some great frocks, some really terrible frocks too. But it was probably one of the best Oscars, I think, in a long time.
That's wonderful to hear. Karen, thank you very much indeed. That's Karen Krasanovich there. And this is The Globalist. Thank you. Department of Defense All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office has released a document entitled Report on the Historical Record of US Government Involvement with Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena. In other words, the Pentagon is talking about UFOs and utterly refuting their existence. I'm joined now by the author, David Badanis. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, good morning.
What does this report actually say?
The report says what every astronomer on Earth and everybody dealing with weather radar, and indeed everybody who's knowledgeable about outer space already knows, is that sadly we haven't been visited by ET.
How does it explain away sightings then?
It turns out that when alien intelligences who want to give great Jesus-like wisdom to mankind arrive on our planet, they don't always stop by drunken people in Georgia named Joe Bob who are looking up after several beers. You might think that they would be in contact, I don't know, visible by all the world's telescopes, but none have seen them.
Oh, it seems extraordinary, though, because, I mean, we even have sort of former government employees. You've testified to Congress about this.
Oh, wait, weren't there former government employees who testified that there was a stolen election in 2020? I tease mercilessly. The former government employees were really low-level people who they did the standard thing in conspiracy theories. They said, I have incredible evidence, but I can't bring it to you now. They always say that. Joe McCarthy said that in the 1950s. So there has never been any evidence of this. I think the reason people don't want to believe the Pentagon is if you believe the Pentagon about this, you have to believe the deep state has accuracy. You have to believe that science and rationality and modern scientific tools can tell us about the external world. That undermines all this resistance to global warming. It undermines all the respect for the establishment. Sorry, the disrespect for the establishment.
So you think people won't believe this report?
Sadly, the people who are committed, put it this way, if you do believe the report, you have to say, oh my goodness, I was really wrong to question technocratic experts in the government or people tell me what the actual atmosphere in outer space is like. And very few people have the ability to do that.
So do you think that the Pentagon's just giving more weight to conspiracy theories by having a department that investigates them and releases reports?
One of the critiques of Freudian psychology is that whatever you say can be interpreted either way. Suppose the Pentagon has a department like this. Well, you could say, oh, that shows that there's something there. Suppose the Pentagon doesn't have a department like this. You can say, oh, they're really hiding it. You're stuck either way.
I want to go back to the 1950s, and I'm thinking particularly here of Roswell, actually, because that was really when all of this UFO conspiracy theories really began, wasn't it?
Sure.
And the report actually sort of addresses that and says that there were various things going on, like the development of the Manhattan Project, and I think some kind of military aircraft was being tested.
Oh, sure. So there are all sorts of things in the sky, but like drones and airplanes and Venus seen low in the sky. There's all sorts of like surprising stuff, but there's never been anything whatsoever that any astronomer at all with any verifiable equipment. These, by the way, are people who spend every night looking at the stars, linked up to recording equipment. They've never seen anything that doesn't fit one of these simple explanations.
Tell me now more about conspiracy theories, though. Why are people so willing to believe, not everybody, of course, but so willing to believe things?
Oscar Wilde once said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. If there's no conspiracy theory, suppose astrology doesn't work. You're stuck all alone in a cold universe. But suppose astrology does work. I can be sitting on the famous Clapham Omnibus crossing the bridge in London, and I might feel a little schlub going to a really boring schlubby job, it's a technical word. But if astrology is true, all the powers of the universe are paying attention to me, me, me. It's kind of like the joys of childhood with a good mommy.
I think you're absolutely right. So my producer was messaging me late last night, and she said, I think you really should ask David about this. And I looked at it, and it was a picture of the Princess of Wales. Now, I don't know if you've been following all of this, but this is our sort of big conspiracy theory of the day.
Yeah, well, I do have to say that what I was saying earlier applies to most people except for advanced Romulans who come to royal families on islands off the European coast, and they take the left hand of little girls, they cut them off, and they shift them an inch or 2 inches to the right, which I believe was the flaw in that Photoshop picture. The thing is, I suppose what's good about that photo, criticism of that photograph is two things. One, photo agencies know they will lose importance if they let obvious fakes go through. The other one is, honestly, it's not such a bad thing. Famous people have stylists and they redo and they Photoshop and stuff like that. You know, every now and then a female actress who's who feels, look, they've made me like skinnier or fatter for no reason. These things are highly artificially produced. Indeed, you might say some of the public sayings of individuals in our public life are also highly artificially produced.
Well, absolutely. And just for people who haven't followed the story, the kind of conspiracy theory behind this is that, and in fact, it's not a conspiracy. That clearly was a Photoshop picture, but it was the first picture released of the Princess of Wales since her hospital stay. And of course, there's been all this gossip and rumour about the fact that nobody's seen her. She's terribly, terribly ill. In fact, there was even a magazine article saying she was near death. I think it was published in Spain or somewhere. And then these photographs were released yesterday and then immediately withdrawn by the photo agency.
Yeah. Now, lowercase r Republicans say that they it's not a conspiracy theory, but they would say, look at the distraction going on. There's no thought that some people in Britain automatically get to jump to the front of the queue and have private medicine automatically, independent of the significance of their health problems compared to other people. That's not an object for discussion. The object for discussion is a PR, a spin. So I'm not saying it's wrong for the royal family to jump to the front of the queue for any medical stuff, but it's not open to debate. When you focus on Donald Trump is fabulous on this. He'll focus on one aspect of something and keep on shifting the debate. Mm. Boris Johnson would also do that. When he was uncomfortable with something, he would shift the debate to something else, often by bringing in something ridiculous. Do you remember when there was a document leaked a while ago that Boris Johnson, when he was going to put some of his cronies in the House of Lords, they said, well, let's put in one person, let's nominate one person who's clearly ridiculous. So the whole attention will be on that one person, and the other, the standard Tory donors or oligarchs or whatever, can go in under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose whenever one sees a conspiracy theory being discussed, you can wonder, as a deeper conspiracy theory, what is being pushed aside and just not on our horizon?
No, absolutely. I like the way that you describe what Johnson and Trump do. I would call it lying.
So with Trump, it'll actually be lies. One of the things that Johnson does, which is really irritating on interviews, remember he got that fine fellow from the BBC to say, please stop talking. Johnson will say, I'm just going to start rambling off about other things. It might be actually fully accurate, but it's not the issue. I'll just go on to side issues and fill the space.
David Badanis, thank you very much. And remember, the truth is out there. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers Lillian Fawcett, Laura Kramer and Monica Lillis, our researcher Neoma Ekwe and our studio manager Mariella Bevan. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London. Chris Chermak will be with you for that. And The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.